Rangers J2 engine.
Well, let me tell you what my background is. I came on J2, and when I came here in August of 60, contract was let September of 60. Mm-hmm. And as far as my dealings with Lewis, prior to that time, I had none. And from the time that I got on the contract, it was a matter of, it was already a design that had been bought by the government, so to speak. And of course, the design that we bought, as we progressed through development, ran into problems. Of course, there were times where we borrowed on past experience. But to the best of my knowledge, all of the design concepts in that engine, Rocketdyne had certainly utilized those. I guess at that time, the only thing we had in hydrogen fuel was the RL-10. Mm-hmm. And of course, it was a somewhat different engine in that the way it started. And of course, the thrust levels was quite a jump from the RL-10 engine to the J2 and thrust level, weight and so forth, and also requirements. I guess mainly what the restart requirements at that time. Mm-hmm. We had restart requirements. But I guess from the, there were probably a couple of areas that problems that we encountered, experiences that we took from the RL-10 program. I guess one was an injector. Mm-hmm. And the concept developed there, the rigid mesh injector, which is nothing more than a transpiration cool of the face by bleeding hydrogen through from the backside. Mm-hmm. Hydrogen came in into a manifold and dumped in between the LOX side and the combustion side. And there was an annulus, which the LOX bud was in the middle, and the fuel fed in into that annulus and was then mixed with the LOX, and of course the combustion process took place. But a percentage of that, I think it varied anywhere from 2 to 3%, flowed through the rigid mesh face. Now, the early injectors that Rocketdyne proposed, the old flat face H1 type, which I never had much dealings with H1 and before I got on J2, but they were the old flat face, like on like ringed injectors. Mm-hmm. Copper rings. Mm-hmm. And we had face burning with them, and also the type impingement they had. We weren't able to get the performance, specific impulse out of them. Mm-hmm. And I guess we struggled along there for early part of the program in the thrust chamber injector program, trying to meet the C-star requirements, ISP requirements. And a number of the problems we ran into, of course, was this face burning problem. And this is what we did. We pulled that experience out of the RL-10 program and applied to the J2. This resolved the face burning problem. So how I guess, and,
I was going to ask you now, how long were you trying to use the H1 injector face in there before you went to the rigid mesh stuff? How many?
Well, I had to go back. We got the records, but as I remember, I had to go back and check to be sure, but as I remember, it was up into October. Let's see, we fired in 62. So we were in 61, about the middle part of 61 before we made that change. Mm-hmm. And they cranked up, I believe, about four months into the program, as I remember, from the time they had the contract. And the first firing in the thrust chamber stand, which was a water-cooled jacketed combustion chamber. That's when we began to find out some of the face cooling problems we had. Mm-hmm. And of course, after several design iterations, and of course, you know, a contractor, he never likes to be asked to use a concept somebody else has used. I mean, this is just general nature. He'd rather design around it than somebody stand up and tell him he's got to take something that his competitor has used. Mm-hmm. Of course, that's not for the record, but mm-hmm. that's the way it goes. It's been, you know, sometimes it's not invented here. They're not interested.
Yeah.
especially when it's the competitor's idea.
Did you have to start to kind of push that down Rocketdyne's
throat? Oh, we had to. I mean, we were way behind on performance.
Yeah.
You know, like the spec at that time, of course, it was based on a mixed ratio of 5.0 and 200K engine. Mm-hmm. And the spec at that time was 422 seconds at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And we were running around somewhere around 415 to 419 with old type injectors.
Mm-hmm.
And the main reason being was, I guess, trying to get the mixed ratio distribution across the injector face with that type of injector is pretty difficult. Not only that, but as you go out towards the periphery, you have to be very careful about how your locks and pinions is emitted out of the injector.
Mm-hmm.
You get too much up against the wall, then you're either forced to put more film cooling in, which is you lose performance. If you add fuel to the wall to keep it cool, and you lose performance, because then you're getting out of balance mixed ratio. You'd like to run, in this case, you'd like to run around 5.1. That's injector mixed ratio now, not overall engine. So if you're running 5.1 in a core, on wall you're running 3.5.4. That's performance law.
Mm-hmm.
Because ideally you'd like to approach stoichiometric.
Mm-hmm.
So I would say that the thing you're talking about, what did we learn out of past program? What was probably a major benefit from past program, or what technology base did we extrapolate from? I would have to say that probably the RL10 in the injector area was a great benefit to it.
Do you know anything? Was it the Paul company or a guy named Paul who developed that rigid mesh?
Paul company.
Yeah, face. Does that strike a bell with you?
Yeah.
Okay, is that the one? PALL?
Yeah, I think that's it. I think, you know Dave Christensen?
He's the one who put me on you.
Yeah.
You can thank him for that later.
Yeah, I think Dave used to represent them.
Yeah.
At one time.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, that was Paul Corporation, I think, where they got it. I think they're the only ones got it. You know, they're the sole source of that kind of material.
Do you know any more about it? Well, I mean, how it was used in earlier programs? Do you have a line on that?
I think it best to understand, it got started, the application was for filters. That's how it really got started. It was a filter cartridge, or you use a filter media.
Mm-hmm.
And someone had the bright idea, I guess, you know, that one of the things you got to do is keep the face cool. And how do you do it? You know, it's when you start taking flat faces, where you got to drill a hole in the face, you got to depend on heat transfer, which they use copper. And with combustion temperatures we had, it's pretty hot to handle, you know. You got to watch junctures, and the copper alone won't work by itself without having steel ends in order to support the copper. So you got a juncture there where you got a heat transfer problem.
Mm-hmm.
And with the heat fluxes or that we use, you know, that are associated with LOX hydrogen engines as opposed to those that are associated with LOX kerosene engines, LOX RP engines.
Is it different?
Huh?
Fluctuation in heat in the engine?
In the combustion chamber, yeah. It gets a little different when it comes to base area, you know, because it has to do with the emissivity of the gas, mm-hmm. of the exhaust product. Of course, in the F1, you always had that fuel-rich shroud
mm-hmm.
around the periphery. So.
But now, does that affect performance, like hydrogen cooling of the walls in the J-tube? I mean, does the same principle operate?
Well, it's not, you're talking about the ridge mesh phase?
No, just talking about when you were talking about locks dumping out on the edge and ruining your balance on the wall.
Well, you got to put the fuel. Yes, ma'am. Excuse me just 1 minute.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. To answer your question, what I was talking about there is that you got to keep the wall. You got a certain heat flux at the throat.
Mm-hmm.
And your walls have to be kept cool. And so you got two things you got to worry about is right where your combustion is completed, the phase. As you progress down, you got to build up a boundary layer. You always have film cooling. Of course, you want to minimize that film cooling because it's usually fuel rich and it's way out of balance as to where you ought to be burning to get maximum performance.
Mm-hmm.
But what I was telling you there is it, in flat face, you've got to impinge back in this way with your locks. You don't dare let it get on the side of the wall because of the inertia difference between, you know, the density of the locks and opposed to the fuel. The locks penetrates through that stream. where you've got, say, relatively low velocities at the outer periphery in comparison to what you got at the center core. Then you begin to burn on the side of the wall at a very high temperature, because locally the mixed ratio is real high. You're getting up close to stoichiometric, even higher than that. So what you've got to do is you've got to be able to minimize that film cooling so that the spray, the lox, the last element, the time it gets over there, that you've got a uniform mixture, not a glob going through that sheet of fuel and setting up a very local mixture ratio, which are real high. If you do, then you burn right through the wall because the local temperature is really high at that point.
Did you have trouble finding the right kind of steel tubing?
Hmm.
Did you have trouble finding the right kind of steel tubing for the LH2 return flow stuff to keep your wall cool?
No, they use 3/4 to 7.
Mm-hmm.
3/4 to 7 tubes. No, we didn't have any trouble with the tubes. We had more than adequate coolant to throw. Because we put all the fuel, except when we went to the gas generator, which was, 3 or 4 pounds a second. The rest of that flow, which was, say, 78 pounds a second, going through the chamber.
Yeah.
So we had more than adequate cooling. As far as taking care of the heat fluxes were there, as long as everything was uniform. And, of course, you get local conditions. Like sometimes in transit, the J2 was plagued for a while with a fuel pump stall. Whenever you open the LOX valve, about that time, you begin to deprive the system of fuel because the resistance in the system was so great, and there wasn't enough head output at that time when you really needed it in order to open the LOX valve to pour the right amount of fuel in the chamber. So you starved the system, or you had the fuel flowing down. Because the resistance and the fact that your pump was decaying down, you weren't putting out the head.
Mm-hmm.
You open the locks, which is a good quality. And sometimes we burnt the walls, trying to tune the sequence up.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, this fuel pump stall problem, the way we got out of that was going back through the system, taking out delta P where we could. Initially, I guess you might say it was kind of sloppy as far as their care and design. I'm not assuring they had the lowest delta P system. So we had to do that, plus we had to add another stage to the fuel pump. We had a 6-stage axial flow pump. So we had to come back in and add another stage, which went to 7-stage pump, which increased the head output.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, this had to do, too, with the tuning of the LOX valve so that it cracked at the right rate so that the fuel system wasn't overpowered by the LOX system. So you got to affect chamber pressure. And they're both seeing the same thing. Now, if the LOX side is running ahead of the fuel side in pressure, then what's creating the chamber pressure is the LOX side. So the fuel side now has got to work against it. So you got to tune the LOX valve so that the fuel essentially is leading the LOX in pressure.
Mm-hmm. When we were out in Los Angeles, we talked to some people. Paul Fuller, do you know him?
Yeah.
Out there?
Yeah.
And Bob Fontaine was working on the F1 and so on. I think John asked the question that does engine development and design get to be kind of a black art sometimes, that you maybe make a fix on it and the thing works and you're not really quite sure what you did to make it work in the long run. Do you ever have that feeling?
Well, no, not really. I guess the biggest thing sometimes is when you make servo changes.
Okay, that was
at one time.
Right.
That's the thing. A lot of times you have a problem and you think that, well, if you do this and that and so forth, that this correct the problem.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's your best estimate through your analysis and observation of the hardware. But sometimes you make those changes and then you have another problem and then you're not quite sure which one of the three fixes you made simultaneously caused the other problem.
Mm-hmm.
But I think I don't know of any case of any problem we ever had that we didn't eventually thoroughly understand it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we knew what the cause was. Sometimes, like I say, we make too many changes at one time. Sometimes schedule pressures force you to make two or three changes at one time rather than do them one at a time. And of course, as you know, it depends on what part of the development program you're in.
Mm-hmm.
If you're in the early phase and things are going kind of slow, and it just seems like every day you test, something's coming loose, it seems like it's never going to end. And as opposed to your you get on out in the program where you got a lot of testing behind you, and the bulk of the problems have gone away or solved, and then you get these sporadic problems. You know, like you go through two damn engines and you don't even have the problem. In the third engine, there was something you did in manufacturing, or there's some little something that you did is all of a sudden now creeping into that, to an engine. Because there are changes going on all the time, really. If you're going to get there, you got to make them. Mm-hmm. Just, you know, there's several approaches to developing a rocket engine. You can take that first engine out there and you can just test it and test it and test it and repair and repair. So you get all the problems and you make one big block change. And sometimes that may take you a long time ever getting there. Or you can make the change and then you make that change in the pipeline over here where the engines are being built. There's pros and cons to developing an engine, I guess, like that. Some people think it's better to do it on a block basis. Some people think it's better to do it, you know, when you got a problem, fix it and get it into your line.
Is that the way you usually handle it then?
That's the way it's usually done.
Yeah.
It just isn't time, because every time you run a test, you don't want to let a component ride on there. You know you're going to change.
Mm-hmm.
Because you're just, you know, your test, your reliability is based on the number of units and the number of tests. And if you're losing time by not going ahead and making that change really as soon as you can.
I had a question to ask about the failures in the J2 engines on the S2 and S4B stage, mm-hmm. when you had 502.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it was something that you discovered after you put it into a vacuum chamber, tested it, mm-hmm. in vacuum at altitude. Now, weren't there vacuum and altitude tests done before, or was that basically on just the engine throat areas that you didn't get up into the ASI area? Why didn't you discover that before?
Well, we did testing at Tullahoma. We always pulled the sail down, you know, about 2/10 PSI, something like that, which was been adequate, except Tullahoma's sitting in a big hole, which is the whole bottom of the hole is filled with water. And even though there's nitrogen purge, there's still quite a bit of moisture, and that's what this particular problem thrived on. That is, when you were at moist conditions, the minute the fuel started through the line, you started to liquefy the air or the moisture, or you even froze the moisture on the bellows. So therefore, that acted as a dampening device, see?
Yeah.
And then when you put it in, say, an environment of helium, where there is no moisture, there's no ice accumulation, then the thing is allowed to go through its thousands of cycles right quick.
Where did you finally do the test with the helium atmosphere?
Was that after the failure?
That was after the failure.
Yeah, it was after
we
the failure.
We didn't do any testing, so we didn't have any failures. We
had do them out at Santa Susana, that test of the helium?
Yeah, that was done there in Canoga Park.
Mm-hmm. Okay, after the failure, I mean.
After the failure, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I tell you, I think that was just a stroke of luck, really, that we found that thing that quick. That's my personal feeling. Because that's the one you would never think about.
Yeah.
And I have to give Rocketdyne credit. They did a fantastic job of taking what test data and then flight data and piecing all the, you know, putting all the pieces together.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you took the data, it'd tell you, you know, it was two things that went on. One was when the line failed, the star fueled to the injector, to the ASI.
Mm-hmm.
Well, of course, we didn't know that, you know, it was flying. But as you star the fuel, you begin to road the ASI out. You just begin to burn the whole center of it out. And when you did that, then of course that changes your C star. Now, if one takes the flight data and tries to go back and says, well, you know, I know something happened. I know I'm losing fuel. We could see that in the environmental data. We could see temperatures, it had to be a fuel leak. And then you say, well, where in the world, how much fuel am I losing? Well, if you go back and assume in the calculations that you've got no damage to the injector. You know what the C star is. You've got hundreds of tests tell you what that is. And you try to balance the engine out with that C star, not knowing it's a damn big hole in the injector. It comes out in terms of you losing so much fuel. So it came out like 6 or 7 pounds of fuel going someplace. When you try to balance it out that way, well, we're talking about an ASI line that was slowing something like a pound or two at the most. Mm-hmm. So that kind of fogged the issue there. Trying to use the balance of what was going on in that flight to say, where in the hell could we lose that much fuel?
Mm-hmm.
You know, what sources? And start taking instrumentation and track it through the system. Mm-hmm. And someone got the bright idea out there, you know, you better start trying some of these lines to see what they do under flow condition. And by doing the test in the environment they did it in, they found out right quick. You know, just it's amazing. I don't know if you've ever seen the pictures or not. Yeah, the actual failure.
I heard there were.
You turn the valves on to start the test, and the line fails like that, practically.
Mm-hmm.
And what amazes me is how we went through all these other flights up until that time. We then had two failures, one on S2 and one on S4B.
Mm-hmm. Well, that first one was a suborbital flight, though. Of course, it's, the S4B is on the S1B.
It's in a vacuum. Yeah. It's always in a hard vacuum.
Yeah.
It start.
Yeah. Were there any other problems with the J2 engine that you recall?
Any other problems?
Yeah. Mentioned the injector face and that little problem with the ASI fuel line.
And of course, that was the pogo problem. I think that was more of a, I wouldn't say it was the engine's problem.
Yeah.
Really, it's just more of a structural problem.
Mm-hmm. What about some of the materials that were used in the J2, like Grenade 48 and Inconel? Were those around at the beginning?
Yeah.
Okay. And could you tell me where you used some of those things specifically?
Yeah, Inconel 718 was used in the injector billet. The injector's made from a big billet, which is Eloxed out. In other words, the post of the injector used an Elox plate, mm-hmm. graphite plate. So all it is electrical discharge machining.
Mm-hmm.
You just take it, make the post. And later on, they drilled it first, then they came back and did Elox on the post with the drill with Elox process.
Mm-hmm.
And with the injector, assembly, manifold, pumps, got Inconel 718
on. Mm-hmm. What about the Rene? Was that primarily an F1 material?
That was, Rene was an F1 material.
Yeah.
I don't
know. What are the Kel F lines? I just don't know.
Huh?
The Kel F or whatever.
Kel F liners?
Yeah.
Kel F?
It's just, I have no idea what that is.
Well, let's see. You have had a KLF liner and a LOX pump.
In the LOX pump?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
In the inducer area, uh-huh. color area. And all that was for us was protect the blade surfaces from the walls of the housing. In case there's a part that ever came in and got lodged between, that would be scrubbing mm-hmm. against the surface. You'd have a plastic protection, you know, keep from building up any heat. Or if the inducer ever kissed, because of a bearing or something, mm-hmm. suddenly went bad. You have a certain amount of motion in that you'd be kissing plastic for a while before you finally got through the metal, where then you could build up heat, blow the LOX pump.
Okay. There's another question I had. Oh, about the gimbling system, did you ever go to a mechanical screw system?
Mechanical screw?
Yeah.
No.
Rock and Down was testing that on some test stands.
They early in the program did some work on a pneumatic actuator.
Yeah.
Hydrogen driven turbine.
Yeah.
Ball screw fair.
But they never worked out very well.
Well, they just never did much on it. It was what they proposed.
Yeah.
It was a proposal they made, and they built one or two and tried them out. But they didn't have enough oomph to them, you know, and didn't have enough power to give the rates that we required.
Mm-hmm.
It was very sluggish.
Okay, another question. How do you go about uprating an engine when you went from 200 to 230K?
Hmm.
When you start with a 200K engine, what do you have to do to it to reach the desired thrust level, the higher one?
We went from 200 to 225 and then went to 230K.
Yeah.
Second. Well.
In two separate steps?
Yeah, it's two separate steps. That's kind of a hard one. Well, first of all, the engine, when it was designed at a thrust point of 200K and a 5-0 mixture ratio, and it had a PU valve,
okay,
which allowed an excursion of 5 mixture ratio units
mm-hmm.
on either side of that. In other words, that would have taken you to 5-5 mixture ratio or from 4 to 4-5 from the null 5-0. And that's if you vary the mixture ratio. In this case, it was bypassing locks around the LOX pump. Then your thrust is going to vary. You're either taking out locks or you're putting more in, one or the other. In this case, your thrust is going to rise. Well, in the J2, when it was bought, it was a 5-0, 200K. And that was where it was going to be acceptance tested with the PU excursion. Well, since the engine was orificed, 5-0, then you had no control of the exact thrust that you'd get when you go to either end of the excursion. It just so happened that when you went to the 5.5, you could go as high as 238 K.
What was the factor that was
as
there?
As high as.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay. So, as the design of the S2 stage progressed and they got to thinking more of the missions and what the requirements were, they came up with a scheme of flying of the first portion of it at 5.5 and when they needed the high thrust, then the last, say, third portion of the burn and going back down to the lower mixed ratio for the specific impulse. So as you go up, you lost gain, it's like this, the curve, specific impulse. And as you go out towards a higher mixture ratio, you don't get the specific impulse, but you get the higher thrust. That's more important in the trajectory equations at that particular time, the S2 boost. And then later on in flight, you're not so concerned about thrust anymore. You need ISP, so you switch it back the other way. So that your thrust goes down, but your ISP is going up.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was kind of the way it was, where the engine was burned, and the S2 and the S1B, S4B. It had that profile, same profile.
Do you have to start upgrading stuff though, like the turbo pumps and everything else when you start doing that?
Well, you gotta start testing that way.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay,
what about the structures that these interface with? Has that all been taken care of beforehand? That it will stand the stress of another
When we went to 225K, we arched the engine at the 5.5 mix ratio in. Mm-hmm. That gave us very precise thrust at the end.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we calibrated the engine 225 plus or minus about 6K. And usually the engine ran within 2 or 3K of the value. Mm-hmm. You know, air firing would be within that dispersion, about 225. Well, wherever it was calibrated, you had about. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it was calibrated 227K.
How do you go about calibration? Just the
just changing orifice floor, bouncing out there.
Where do you get your calibration standards? Just accumulated data.
Well, he got a computer program that models the engine,
mm-hmm.
and before you have flow test on various components, you have this data. You got pump data. All your pumps are green run before they go in the engine, so you know what their performance are,
mm-hmm.
You take all this data and you put it in a computer and it comes out and tells you where the first cut to make, what the orifice should be put in there. And if it's not exactly on the first run that you make, then you come back and change the orifice and you make another cut at it. And usually about two runs, you get really, further along you get in the program, you get pretty good at it. You usually make it the first cut. But until you develop that skill and learn to get enough data, I guess that's what it amounts to, on valves, you know,
mm-hmm.
what kind of spurs, you know, what influences the valve have on the balance of the engine and so forth. Or the chambers, you know, chambers have various delta P's in them. Pumps have different efficiencies. You know, they're very narrow, but when you start talking about, say, hitting something within 3K out of 225, that's pretty close to shooting.
So one other question, we're about to end of the tape here and we want to ask for a half an hour and so that we've done it.
Yeah.
What does the J in the J2 mean?
The J?
Yeah.
What does it mean?
You know where they got the F and the F1 and the H and the
H1? Series, and I never really stopped to think where they got it.
Yeah. It's kind of a series, right?
It's just a series of...
started off with...
A, B, C, B...
They went up all, but they started out with F.
H1, F1, and J, H. Yeah. I guess that's a, I don't know. I never thought of how they.
It's kind of in the series. No, it's not like anything else. It's not uniform.
It's like flying the SA-203 before the SA-202. Okay.
I don't know. It's just...
That's what, you know, it comes from. It's what people at Rocketdyne don't
mind. I've forgotten that.